Muhammad, Disc 4.
In the meantime, the Muslims were anxiously awaiting their arrival in Medina. Several of the emigrants from Mecca were living in Quba, the southernmost point of the oasis. And every day after morning prayers, they used to climb the volcanic rocks and scan the barren terrain outside the settlement. On the morning of September the 4th, 622, one of the Jews spotted a cloud of dust on the horizon and called out to the Ansar, "Sons of Kaila, he's come, he's come." At once, men, women and children surged out to meet the travellers and found them resting under a palm tree. Muhammad and Abu Bakr stayed in Quba for 3 days. But the Muslims in the city, as the most densely populated part of the oasis was called, were impatient to see him. So he set off to meet them and decide where he was going to live. Along the way, several people begged him to alight and make his home with them, but Muhammad courteously refused because he was anxious to remain independent of the warring groups within Medina. Instead, he gave Qaswa her head and asked God to guide her. Eventually, she fell to her knees outside a mirbad, a place for drying dates, which belonged to one of the Ansar. Muhammad got down, allowed his luggage to be carried into the nearest house, and then began to negotiate with the owner for the sale of the land. Once the price was agreed upon, all the Muslims got to work to build the Prophet's residence, which would also serve as a place for prayer. This was hard for the emigrants because the Quraysh were not used to manual labour, and the stylish Uthman found the work particularly gruelling. The first Muslim building was not imposing, but it became the model for all future mosques. It was primarily a masjid, a place of prostration, an open space roomy enough for the entire community to perform the prayer together, and it expressed the austerity of the early Islamic ideal. The roof was supported by tree trunks, and there was no elaborate pulpit. Muhammad stood on a simple stool to address the congregation. Muhammad and his wives lived in little huts round the edge of the big courtyard in front of the mosque. This was a place for public and political meetings. The poor of Medina were also invited to congregate there for alms, food and care. This humble building in Medina expressed the ideal of tawhid, unity. Muhammad wanted to show that the sexual, the sacred, and the domestic could, and indeed must, be integrated. Similarly, politics, welfare, and the ordering of social life must be brought into the ambit of holiness. In housing his wives within a stone's throw of the mosque, Muhammad was tacitly proclaiming that there must be no distinction between public and private life and no discrimination between the sexes. Holiness in Islam was inclusive rather than exclusive. If they wished, Jews and Christians could worship in the mosque because they too were part of God's family. The building was completed in April 623, about 7 months after the Hijra. In the northern wall, a stone marked the Qibla, the direction of prayer, orienting the people towards Jerusalem. At first, there was no official summons to Salat, the ritual prayer, but this was obviously unsatisfactory as everybody came at different times. Muhammad thought of using a ram's horn, like the Jews, or a wooden clapper, like the local Christians, but one of the emigrants had an important dream. A man clad in a green cloak had told him that somebody with a loud, resonant voice should announce the service, crying, "Allahu Akbar," God is greater, as a reminder of the Muslim's first priority. Muhammad liked the idea, and Bilal, the former Abyssinian slave with the big voice, was an obvious choice. Every morning, he climbed to the top of the tallest house in the vicinity of the mosque and sat on the rooftop waiting for dawn. Then he would stretch out his arms and before beginning the call would pray, O God, I praise thee, and ask thy help for Quraysh, that they may accept thy religion. The Muslims may have changed their Qibla, the direction of their prayer, to Jerusalem, but they had not forgotten Mecca. When Muhammad learned that many of the emigrants were deeply homesick, he prayed, Lord, make us love this town as much as you made us love Mecca, and even more so. The immense uprooting of the Hijra meant that even though they still used the old tribal terminology, the Muslims had to create an entirely different type of community. One of the first things Muhammad did was set up a system of brothering, whereby each Meccan was assigned an Ansar brother to help Muslims to bond across the lines of kinship. The political separation of emigrants and helpers was soon dropped. When the first of the 12 Ansari overseers died, Muhammad simply took over his position. The Muslims were gradually creating a neo-tribe, which interpreted the old kinship relationships differently. Those who had made the Hijra were to regard themselves as distinct from the Muslims who remained behind in Mecca, even though they all belonged to the same blood group. Whatever their tribe or clan, Muslims must never fight one another. Emigrants and helpers must become as solidly united as any conventional tribe. Like the tribe, the Ummah, the community, was one community to the exclusion of all men and would make confederates of non-Muslim allies in the usual way. As chieftain of the Ummah, Muhammad could now implement his moral and social reforms in a way that had been impossible in Mecca. His goal was to create a society of hilm, of mercy and forbearance. Those who kept the faith, the mu'min, were not simply believers. Their faith must be expressed in practical actions. They must pray, share their wealth, and in matters that concerned the community, consult among themselves to preserve the unity of the Ummah. If attacked, they could defend themselves, but instead of lashing out in the old, uncontrolled Jahili way, they must always be prepared to forgive an injury. Automatic, vengeful retaliation, the cardinal duty of the tribe, could be a great evil. Hence, whoever pardons his foe and makes peace, his reward rests with God, the Quran insisted tirelessly. If one is patient in adversity and forgives, this, behold, is indeed something to set one's heart upon. This transformation could not be achieved overnight, because the old spirit of Jahiliya still lurked in Muslim hearts. Shortly after the Hijra, one of the pagan Arabs noticed a crowd of Muslims, which included members of both Aus and Khazraj, chatting together amicably as though their tribes had never been sworn enemies. He was furious. Clearly Islam was making them soft and feeble. He ordered a young Jewish man to sit near the group and recite poems that reminded them of the old bitter feuds. It was not long before the ingrained tribal chauvinism flared up and the Muslims were soon at one another's throats. Muhammad hurried to the scene in great distress. Are you still tempted by the call of Jahiliya when I am here among you? He demanded. When God has guided you, honoured you, and cut off thereby the bond of Jahiliya from you, delivered you from a state of defiant ingratitude, and made you friends of each other. Deeply ashamed, the Ansar wept and embraced. Not all the Muslims of Medina were committed to change. Some had embraced Islam purely for material gain, and they were sitting on the fence, waiting to see how this new venture would turn out. The Quran called these people the waverers or the hypocrites, munafiqun, because they were not sincere and kept changing their minds. When they were with devout Muslims, they cried, "We believe as you believe." But in the company of other doubters, they assured them, "Verily, we are with you. We were only mocking. Their leader was Ibn Ubay, who had become a Muslim but remained resentful and critical of the new faith. Muhammad always behaved respectfully to him and allowed him to address the community every week during the Friday prayers, but from time to time his buried hostility came to the surface. "Don't be hard on him," one of the helpers begged Muhammad after a particularly unpleasant incident, "for before God sent you to us, we were making a diadem to crown him, and by God, he thinks you have robbed him of a kingdom." Some of the Jews were also becoming hostile to the newcomers. Muhammad did not expect them to convert to Islam, and their quarrel with him was not primarily religious, but political and economic. The Jews' position in the oasis had deteriorated, and if Muhammad succeeded in uniting Aus and Khazraj, they would have no chance of regaining their former supremacy. Hence, three of the larger Jewish tribes thought it wiser to support Ibn Ubay and the pagan Arabs in the oasis, who remained opposed to Muhammad. The early Muslim historians tell us that they mounted a scholarly polemic against the theology of the Quran, but this probably reflected Jewish-Muslim debate during the 8th and 9th centuries. The Jews of 7th century Medina had only a limited knowledge of Torah and Talmud, were not strictly observant, and most were used to seeing their faith as a variant of Arabian religion. The idea of an Arabian prophet was not a strange idea to them. They had a prophet of their own, called Ibn Sayyad, who, like Muhammad, wrapped himself in a cloak, recited inspired verses, and claimed to be the apostle of God.
In rabbinical debates,
the Muslims probably encountered a good deal of populist religious chauvinism in Medina. Ibn Ishaq tells us that when they came to the mosque, some of the Jews would laugh and scoff at the Quran. Many Jews were friendly, and Muhammad probably learned a great deal from them. But some of the people of the book had ideas that he found very strange indeed. The idea of an exclusive religion was alien to Muhammad. He hated sectarian quarrels and was offended by the idea of a chosen people, or the conviction that only Jews or Christians could get to paradise. He was also bewildered to learn that some Christians believed that God was a Trinity and that Jesus was the Son of Allah. But he remained convinced that these peculiar notions were the heretical deviations of a deluded minority. The Quran reminded Muslims that many of the people of the book were upright people who recite God's messages throughout the night and prostrate themselves before him. They believe in God and the last day and enjoin the doing of what is right and forbid the doing of what is wrong and vie with one another in doing God's works, and these are among the righteous. Muslims must remember that every community had its own specially revealed religion, so they must not take part in these pointless squabbles. If the people of the book attacked their faith, Muslims must behave with hilm and courteously reply, "God knows best what you are doing." To avoid this sterile controversy, Muhammad, like the Hanifs, decided to return to the religion of Abraham, who was neither a Jew nor a Christian because he had lived long before either the Torah or the Gospel. After the Hijra, the Quran started to apply the words Hanif and Hanifiya to the Muslims and Islam, but gave these words a new interpretation. For Muhammad, Hanifiya simply meant total submission to God. This had been the original, unadulterated message of the prophets before it had been corrupted by sectarian chauvinism. Abraham, for example, had not belonged to an exclusive cult. He had simply been a Muslim, one who surrendered himself, and a Hanif, a man of pure faith. When Abraham and Ishmael had rebuilt the Kaaba together, they had not developed an exclusive theology, but had simply wanted to give their lives entirely to Allah. "O our sustainer," they had prayed, make us surrender ourselves unto thee, and show us our ways of worship. Muslims had been driven out of Mecca because of religious intolerance, so they must avoid all exclusivity. Instead of stridently insisting that they alone had the monopoly of truth, the true Muslims merely said, "Behold my prayer and all my acts of worship and my living and my dying are for God alone, the sustainer of all the worlds." It was idolatry to take pride in belonging to a particular religious tradition, rather than concentrating upon Allah himself. At the end of January 624, Muhammad received a revelation while he was leading the Friday prayers and made the congregation turn around and pray in the direction of Mecca instead of Jerusalem. They would now face the house built by Abraham, the man of pure faith. "We have seen thee, O Prophet," said God, "often turn thy face towards heaven for guidance. And now we shall indeed make thee turn too in prayer in a direction which will fulfill thy desire. Turn then thy face towards the inviolable house of worship. And wherever you all may be, turn your faces towards it in prayer." It was a reminder that they were not following any of the established religions, but God himself. It was a declaration of independence. Muslims need no longer feel that they were following lamely in the footsteps of the older faiths. "Hold them not in awe," God said, "but stand in awe of me and obey me." The new Qibla, or direction of prayer, delighted both the emigrants and the helpers and would bind them more closely together. They all loved the Kaaba, which was more deeply rooted in Arab tradition than the distant city of Jerusalem. But there was a problem. The Kaaba was in Mecca, and relations with the Quraysh had recently become more strained than ever before. Chapter 4. Jihad. The change of Qibla, the direction of prayer, had occurred at the end of a period of uncertainty. Muhammad and the community had been restlessly turning this way and that, searching for guidance in their confusion. Muhammad knew that a prophet had to make a difference to the world. He could not simply withdraw from the mainstream. He had to put God's revealed will into practice and create a just egalitarian society. But the Hijra had pushed the Muslims into a peripheral and anomalous position. Even though Muhammad had begun to implement his social reforms, he knew that he would make no lasting impression on Arabia as long as he was confined to and isolated in Medina. Mecca, the mother of cities, was crucial to the development of the peninsula. Arabia needed the commercial genius of the Quraysh. Mecca was now the centre of the Muslim world. Muslims yearned towards it in prayer several times a day, but it was coming to seem like an absent, inaccessible lover. Muslims could not even make the Hajj like other Arabs. Muhammad realized that Mecca was the key to his mission. The hostility of the Quraysh had eradicated the Ummah from the tribal map and pushed it into a political limbo. Without Mecca, Islam was doomed to marginality. Somehow Muhammad would have to make peace with his people. But after the first shock of the Hijra, most of the Quraysh seemed to have forgotten all about the Muslims. Before Muhammad could seek reconciliation with Mecca, he had to make the Quraysh take notice of him. He also had to secure his position in Medina. He knew that as far as most of the Medinese were concerned, he was still on trial. They had defied the might of the Quraysh by taking the migrants in because they expected some material advantage. And here too, Muhammad had to deliver. At the very least, he had to ensure that the emigrants did not become a drain upon the economy. But it was difficult for them to earn a living. Most of them were merchants or bankers, but there was very little opportunity for trade in Medina, where the wealthier Arab and Jewish tribes had achieved a monopoly. The emigrants had no experience of farming, and in any case, all the available land had already been taken. They would become a burden to the helpers unless they found an independent source of income, and there was one obvious way to achieve this.
Medina was well placed to attack the Meccan caravans on their way to and from Syria.
And shortly after Muhammad had arrived in Medina, he had started to send bands of emigrants on raiding expeditions. Their aim was not to shed blood, but to secure an income by capturing camels, merchandise, and prisoners who could be held for ransom. Nobody would have been particularly shocked by this development. The ghazu, the acquisition raid, was a normal expedient in times of hardship, though some of the Arabs would have been surprised by the Muslims' temerity in taking on the mighty Quraysh, especially as they were clearly inexperienced warriors. During the first 2 years after the Hijra, Muhammad dispatched 8 of these expeditions. He did not usually go himself, but commissioned people such as Hamza and Ubaidah ibn al-Harith. But it was difficult to get accurate information about the caravan's itinerary, and none of these early raids was successful. The Quraysh were not a warlike people. They had left the nomadic life behind long ago and had lost both the habit and the skill of the ghazu, the warrior. The Quran shows that some of the emigrants found the very idea of fighting distasteful. But Muhammad was not discouraged. Even though the emigrants desperately needed an income, plunder was not his primary objective. The raiders may have come back empty-handed, but they had at least brought the Muslims to the attention of Mecca. The Quraysh were rattled. They had to take precautions that had never been necessary before. Merchants complained that they felt more vulnerable. They had to make inconvenient detours, and the flow of trade in and out of Mecca was slightly disrupted. In September 623, Muhammad himself led a ghazu against a large caravan led by Umayyah ibn Khalaf. The spoils looked so promising that a record 200 Muslims volunteered for the expedition. But yet again, the caravan eluded the raiders, and there was no fighting. In the steppes, the ghazu needed no theoretical justification. It was seen as an unavoidable necessity in time of scarcity. But Muhammad had been determined to transcend the old tribal norms. The Quran had instructed Muslims to say, "Peace be with you," to the kafirun, not attack them while they were going about their business. Shortly after Muhammad arrived in Medina, he received a revelation that took a more militant line. "Permission to fight is given to those against whom war is being wrongfully waged, and verily, God has indeed the power to succour them. Those who have been driven from their homelands against all right for no other reason than their saying, 'Our sustainer is God.' For if God had not enabled people to defend themselves against one another, all monasteries and churches and synagogues and mosques, in all of which God's name is abundantly extolled, would surely have been destroyed ere now."
The Quran had begun to develop a primitive just war theory. In the steppes, aggressive warfare was praiseworthy. But in the Quran, self-defence was the only possible justification for hostilities, and the preemptive strike was condemned. War was always a terrible evil, but it was sometimes necessary in order to preserve decent values, such as freedom of worship. Even here, the Quran did not abandon its pluralism. Synagogues and churches, as well as mosques, should be protected. The Muslims felt that they had suffered a fearful assault. Their expulsion from Mecca was an act that had no justification. Exile from the tribe violated the deepest sanction of Arabia. It had attacked the core of the Muslims' identity. But Muhammad had embarked upon a dangerous course. He was living in a chronically violent society, and he saw these raids not simply as a means of bringing in much-needed income, but as a way of resolving his quarrel with the Quraysh. We have discovered in our own day that waging war for the sake of peace is a high-risk venture. The ruthlessness of battle can lead to actions that flout the very principles that the warriors are fighting for, so that, in the end, neither side can claim the high moral ground. Muhammad tried to give his ghazu ethical grounding, but he had no experience of a long military campaign and would learn that once it had started, a cycle of violence achieves an independent momentum and can spin tragically out of control. At first, Muhammad fought according to the traditional rules, but in January 624, just before the change of the Qibla, he had his first experience of the unpredictability of warfare. The emigrants were becoming more confident. During the winter months, the Quraysh sent their caravans south, so they no longer had to pass Medina. But, ever anxious to attract their attention, Muhammad sent a small raiding party of 9 men to attack one of these southbound caravans. It was the end of Rajab, one of the sacred months when all fighting was forbidden. On the last day of Rajab, the Muslims came upon a small caravan encamped in Nakla. What should they do? If they waited until the following day when the truce ended, the caravan would be able to return unscathed to Mecca. They decided to attack. The first arrow killed one of the merchants. Most of the others fled. But the Muslims took 2 prisoners, whom they brought back to Medina with the captured merchandise. But instead of greeting the raiders as conquering heroes, the Muslims were horrified to hear that the raid had violated the sacred month. For a few days, Muhammad did not know how to respond. He had, after all, abandoned much Meccan religion and may have imagined that he could jettison the forbidden months too. The raid had been a success. Not only were there rich pickings, but he had shown the Quraysh that he could attack them almost on their own doorstep. He had also impressed many of the Medinese. But there was something dubious about the whole business. Muhammad had never condemned the practice of the forbidden months before. The sources seem uneasy about the incident. Muhammad had discovered that, however idealistic your war might be at the outset, something distasteful is likely to occur sooner rather than later. Muhammad received a new revelation that reiterated the central principle of his just war. Yes, it had been wrong to break the sacred truce. But the policy of the Quraysh in driving the Muslims from their homes had been even more heinous. "They will not cease to fight you till they have turned you away from your faith," the Quran warned Muhammad. As to fighting during the forbidden month, this was indeed an awesome thing. But turning men away from the path of God and denying him, and turning them away from the inviolable house of worship and expelling its people therefrom, all this is far more awesome in the sight of God, since oppression is more awesome than killing. Muhammad therefore accepted the booty and reassured the community. He divided the spoils equally among the emigrants and began negotiations with the Quraysh for an exchange of prisoners. He would trade the Meccan captives for 2 Muslims still living in Mecca who wanted to make the Hijra. But one of the prisoners was so impressed by what he saw in Medina that he decided to remain and convert to Islam. The incident is a good example of the way Muhammad was beginning to work. In his novel position, he could not rely on customary procedure. He was feeling his way forward, step by step,
responding to events as they unfolded. He had no fixed master plan, and, unlike some of his more impetuous companions, he rarely responded to a crisis immediately, but took time to reflect until finally, sometimes pale and sweating with the effort, he would bring forth what seemed an inspired solution. A few weeks later, during the month of Ramadan, March 624, Muhammad led a large Muslim contingent to intercept a Meccan caravan that Abu Sufyan was bringing back from Syria. This was one of the most important caravans of the year, and, encouraged by the success of Nakhla, a large contingent of helpers volunteered to join the raid. About 314 Muslims set out from Medina and rode to the Well of Badr, near the Red Sea coast, where they hoped to ambush the caravan. This expedition would be one of the most formative events in the early history of Islam, but at the outset, it seemed just another ghazu, and several of the most committed Muslims stayed at home, including Uthman ibn Affan, whose wife Ruqayya, the Prophet's daughter, was dangerously ill. At first, it looked as though the caravan would, as usual, escape. Abu Sufyan got wind of the Muslims' plan, and instead of taking his usual route across the Hijaz, he turned sharply away from the coast and dispatched a local tribesman to Mecca to get help. The Quraysh were incensed at Muhammad's insolence, which they regarded as a slur on their honour, and all the leading men were determined to rescue the caravan. Abu Jahl, of course, was eager for the fray. The obese Umayyah ibn Khalaf was crammed into his armour, and even members of Muhammad's own family rode out against him, convinced that this time he had gone too far. Abu Lahab was sick, but two of Abu Talib's sons, his uncle Abbas and Khadija's nephew Hakim, joined the 1,000 men who rode out of Mecca that night and took the road to Badr. In the meantime, Abu Sufyan had managed to elude the Muslims and taken the caravan beyond their reach. He sent word that the merchandise was safe and that the army should turn back. The sources make it clear that when it came to the point, many of the Quraysh were reluctant to fight their kinsmen. But Abu Jahl would have none of this. "By Allah," he cried, "we will not go back until we have been to Badr. We will spend 3 days there, slaughter camels, and feast and drink wine, and the girls shall play for us. The Arabs will hear that we have come and will respect us in the future." But these defiant words show that Ibn Abu Jahl did not expect a battle. He had little conception of the horror of war, which he seemed to envisage as a kind of party complete with dancing girls. The Quraysh were so far removed from the steppes that warfare had become a chivalric sport that would enhance the prestige of Mecca. There was a very different spirit in the Muslim camp. After the trauma and terror of the Hijra, the emigrants could not view the situation in such a confident, carefree light. As soon as Muhammad learnt that the Meccan army was approaching, he consulted the other chiefs. The Muslims were vastly outnumbered. They had expected an ordinary raid, not a full-scale battle, which was a very different matter. Muhammad was not the commander-in-chief. He could not command obedience, but the men decided to fight it out. As Sa'd ibn Mu'adh said on behalf of the helpers, "We have given you our word and agreement to hear and obey. So go where you wish, and we are with you. And by God, if you were to ask us to cross this sea and you plunged into it, we would plunge into it with you. We do not dislike the idea of meeting your enemy tomorrow. We are experienced in war, trustworthy in combat." Unlike the Quraysh, the Aus and Khazraj were practiced soldiers after years of tribal warfare in Yathrib. But even so, the odds were overwhelmingly against them, and all the Muslims hoped that they would not have to fight. For 2 days, the two armies gazed bleakly at one another from opposite ends of the valley. The Quraysh looked impressive in their white tunics and glittering armour, and despite Sa'd's stirring words, some of the Muslims wanted to retreat. There was great fear in the camp. The Prophet tried to rouse their spirits. He told them that in a dream God had promised to send 1,000 angels to fight alongside them. But while the Quraysh were feasting and drinking, certain that the Muslims would surrender, Muhammad was making practical preparations. He lined up his troops in close formation and positioned his men by the wells, depriving the Quraysh of water and forcing them, when the time came, to advance uphill, fighting with the sun in their eyes. But when he looked at the huge Meccan army, he wept. "O Allah," he prayed, "if this band that is with me perishes, there will be no one after me to worship you. All the believers will abandon the true religion." He realized that this battle would be decisive. If the Muslims allowed the Quraysh to force them back into Medina, the Ummah would make no lasting impact on Arabia. Something of his determined resolve must have been conveyed to his men. The Quran describes the great peace that descended upon the soldiers at this frightening moment. There was a sudden rainstorm, which seemed a good omen. The Quraysh had become more alarmed. The chiefs had dispatched a spy to report on the enemy troops. He was aghast to see the grim resolution on the faces of the Muslims and begged the Quraysh not to fight. He had seen camels carrying death, the camels of Yathrib laden with certain death. Not one of the Muslims would die before he had killed at least one of the Meccans. And, the spy concluded despairingly, how could the Quraysh live with themselves after that? They would constantly be looking into the face of a neighbour who had killed one of their kinsfolk. But Abu Jahl was beyond reason and accused him of cowardice, a jibe that no Arab could ignore. He then turned to the brother of the man slain by the Muslim raiders at Nakhla, who emitted a savage war cry. "Immediately," said the historian Ibn Ishaq, "war was kindled and all was marred, and the folk held stubbornly to their evil course." The Quraysh began to advance slowly over the sand dunes. Observing the command of the Quran, Muhammad refused to strike first, and even after the battle commenced, he seemed reluctant to unleash his men until Abu Bakr told him to leave his prayers and engage his troops, because God would certainly give them victory. In the fierce skirmish that followed, the Quraysh soon found that they were getting the worst of it. They fought with careless bravado, as though this was a nightly tournament, and had no concerted strategy. But the Muslims did have a disciplined plan. They began by bombarding the enemy with arrows, drawing their swords for hand-to-hand combat only at the last minute. By midday, the Quraysh had fled in disarray, leaving some 50 of their leading men, including Abu Jahl himself, dead on the field. There were only 14 Muslim casualties. Jubilantly, the Muslims began to round up the prisoners and draw their swords. In tribal warfare, there was no quarter for the vanquished. Casualties were mutilated, and captives were either slain or tortured. Muhammad immediately ordered his troops to desist. A revelation came down to ensure that the prisoners of war must either be released or ransomed. Even in war, Muslims would abjure the savage customs of the past. Constantly, the Quran insists upon the importance of mercy and forgiveness, even during armed conflict. While engaged in hostilities, Muslims must fight with courage and steadfastness in order to bring the conflict to an end as quickly as possible. But the moment the enemy asks for peace, Muslims must lay down their arms. They must accept any offer of truce, whatever conditions are imposed, even if they suspect the enemy of double-dealing. And although it is important to fight persecution and oppression, the Quran constantly reminds Muslims that it is much better to sit down and solve the problem by courteous discussion. True, God permitted retaliation in the Torah. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. But, said the Quran, he who shall forego it out of charity will atone better for some of his past sins.
Would be strictly confined to those who had actually perpetrated the atrocity.
A great advance on the law of vendetta, which permitted revenge against any member of the killer's tribe. The Quran reminded the Muslims that they were not fighting the whole tribe of Quraysh. Those who had remained neutral throughout the conflict and those Muslims who had chosen to remain in Mecca must not be attacked or injured in any way. Muhammad was not a pacifist. He believed that warfare was sometimes inevitable and even necessary. After the Battle of Badr, the Muslims knew that it was only a matter of time before Mecca took her revenge, and they dedicated themselves to a long, grueling jihad. But the primary meaning of that word jihad, which we hear so often today, is not holy war, but the effort or struggle necessary to put the will of God into practice. Muslims are exhorted to strive in this endeavor on all fronts, intellectual, social, economic, spiritual, and domestic. Sometimes they would have to fight, but this was not their chief duty. On their way home from Badr, Muhammad uttered an important and oft-quoted maxim. We are returning from the lesser jihad, the battle, and going to the greater jihad, the immeasurably more important and difficult struggle to reform their own society and their own hearts. Badr had given Muhammad a far higher profile in the oasis. As they prepared for the inevitable Quraysh riposte, a covenant was drawn up between the Prophet and the Arab and Jewish tribes of Medina, who agreed to live peaceably beside the Muslims and promised not to make a separate treaty with Mecca. All the inhabitants were required to defend the oasis against attack. The new constitution was careful to guarantee the religious freedom of the Jewish clans, but expected them to provide aid to whosoever wars against the people of this document. Muhammad needed to know who was on his side, and some of those who were unwilling to accept the terms of the treaty left the oasis. They included several of the Hanifs, whose devotion to the Kaaba required them to remain loyal to the Quraysh. Muhammad was still a controversial figure, but as a result of his victory at Badr, some of the Bedouin tribes were willing to become allies of Medina in the forthcoming struggle. There were also changes in Muhammad's family life. On his return from Badr, he learned that his daughter Ruqayyah had died. Uthman was sincerely grieved, but was glad to accept the hand of his late wife's sister, Kulthum, and retain his close relationship with the Prophet. One of the prisoners of war was Muhammad's pagan son-in-law, Abu al-As, who had remained true to the traditional faith. His wife Zainab, who was still living in Mecca, sent the ransom money to Medina, together with a silver bracelet that had belonged to Khadija. Muhammad recognized it at once and became momentarily distraught with sorrow. He let Abu al-As go free without taking the ransom, hoping that this would encourage him to accept Islam. He refused conversion, but sadly agreed to the Prophet's request that he send Zainab and their little daughter Umama to him in Medina, because life would now be impossible for them in Mecca. For Muhammad's youngest daughter, Fatima, to be married, and Muhammad gave her to Ali. the couple set up house near the mosque. Muhammad also took a new wife, Umar's daughter Hafsa, who had been recently widowed. She was beautiful and accomplished, and at the time of her marriage to the Prophet was about 18 years old. Like her father, she could read and write, but she also had Umar's quick temper. Aisha was happy to welcome her into the household. Aisha would be jealous of Muhammad's other wives, but the growing bond between their fathers made these two girls firm friends. They particularly enjoyed ganging up together against the stolid, unimaginative Sauda. Aisha may by this time have moved into the apartment that had been prepared for her in the mosque, though Tabari says that because of her youth, she was allowed to remain for a while longer in her parents' house. Muhammad was an indulgent husband. He insisted that his wives live frugally in their tiny, sparse huts, but he always helped them with the household chores and looked after his own personal needs, mending and patching his clothes, cobbling his shoes, and tending to the family goats. With Aisha particularly, he was able to unwind, challenging her to foot races and the like. She had a sharp tongue and was by no means a shy or submissive wife, but she liked to spoil Muhammad, anointing his hair with his favourite perfume and drinking from the same cup. One day, while they were sitting together, the Prophet busily repairing his sandals, she saw his face light up at a passing thought. Watching him for a moment, she complimented him on his bright, happy expression, and Muhammad got up and kissed her forehead, saying, "O Aisha, may Allah reward you well. I am not the source of joy to you that you are to me." Muhammad lived cheek by jowl with his family and companions and saw no opposition between his public and private life. It was possible for his wives to hear every word that was spoken in the mosque from their apartments. The emigrants had immediately noticed that the women of Medina were different, less rigorously controlled than in Mecca, and soon found that their own wives were picking up the free and easy ways of the Medinese women. Omar was furious when his wife started to answer him back instead of meekly accepting his reproaches, and when he rebuked her, she simply replied that the Prophet allowed his wives to argue with him. Trouble was brewing. Muhammad's deliberate conflation of public and private was a blow to male supremacy, which can only exist if this distinction is maintained.
After the euphoria of victory had faded, Muhammad found that even though his prestige had increased in Arabia as a whole, the fear of an imminent Meccan attack was swelling the opposition party in Medina. Ibn Ubay and his supporters were backed by three of the largest Jewish tribes, Nadir, Quraiza, and Kainuka, who depended upon their commercial links with the Quraysh and wanted no part in any war against Mecca. A third column was opening up in the oasis. About 10 weeks after Badr, Abu Sufyan led a token ghazu of 200 men to the fields outside Medina and under cover of night slipped into the territory of Nadir, where he was entertained by its chief, Salam ibn Mishkan, who, according to Ibn Ishaq, gave him secret information about the Muslims. Muhammad's scouts kept him informed of these developments. These three Jewish tribes were clearly a security risk. They had large armies and were experienced soldiers. If a Meccan army were to camp south of Medina, where Nadir and Quraiza had their territories, it would be easy for them to join forces with the Quraysh and breach the city's defences. If the Quraysh decided to attack from the north, which would be their best option, Nadir and Quraiza could attack the Muslims from the south. But a more urgent concern was Kainuka, the wealthiest of the Jewish tribes and former allies of Ibn Ubay, who controlled the market in the centre of Medina.
the Muslims had established a little market of their own and, for religious reasons, did not charge interest. Taking this as a direct challenge, the Kaynuka decided to break their agreement with the Prophet and join the opposition. Muhammad visited their district and asked them in the name of their common religion to keep the peace. They listened in mutinous silence and then replied, "O Muhammad, you seem to think that we are your people. Do not deceive yourself because you have encountered a tribe at Badr with no knowledge of war and got the better of them. For by Allah, if we fight you, you will find that we are real men." Muhammad withdrew and grimly awaited developments. A few days later, fighting broke out in the market of Kaynuka when one of the Jewish goldsmiths insulted a Muslim woman. As the Hakam, Muhammad was called in to arbitrate, but the chiefs of Kaynuka refused to accept his judgment, barricaded themselves into their fortress, and called upon their Arab allies for aid. Kaynuka had an army of 700 men, and had their allies responded, they would certainly have defeated and probably eliminated the Muslim community. But the Arabs remained staunchly behind the Prophet, and Ibn Ubay found that he was powerless to help
After
his old
siege
confederates.
Of 2 weeks,
the Kaynuka were forced to surrender unconditionally. Muhammad would have been expected to massacre the men and sell the women and children into slavery, the traditional punishment meted out to traitors. But he acceded to Ibn Ubay's plea for clemency and spared them, provided that the whole tribe left Medina immediately. Kaynuka were ready to go. They had taken a gamble, but had underestimated Muhammad's new popularity. Neither their Arab allies nor the other Jews protested. Tribes had often been driven out of the oasis during the internecine wars before the Hijra, so this expulsion was part of a process that had started long before Muhammad's arrival. Bloodshed was avoided, but Muhammad was caught in a tragic moral dilemma. The justification for the jihad against the Quraysh had been the Muslims' exclusion from their native city, which was condemned by the Quran as a great evil. Now, trapped in the aggressive conventions of Arabia, he was compelled to eject another people from their homeland. The people of Medina anxiously waited for the inevitable Meccan attack. Since Abu Jahl had been killed at Badr and Abu Lahab had died shortly afterwards, Abu Sufyan was now the leading chieftain of the Quraysh and a far more formidable opponent. In the late summer, a contingent of Muslim raiders captured a large Meccan caravan. Abu Jahl would have retaliated immediately, but Abu Sufyan did not allow this defeat to interfere with his long-term objectives. He simply intensified his preparations, building up a large confederacy of Bedouin allies. Once the winter rains were over, 3,000 men with 3,000 camels and 200 horses left Mecca on March the 11th, 625, and began their journey northward. After a journey of little over a week, they camped to the northwest of Medina, on the plain in front of Mount Uhud. The Medinis had only a week's notice of the Meccan advance. There was no time to get the crops from the field, but Muhammad and the other chiefs managed to bring in the people from the outlying areas and barricade them into the city. The experienced warriors urged caution. It was very difficult to sustain a siege in Arabia, and they suggested that everybody should stay behind the barricades and refuse to engage with the Quraysh, who would eventually be forced to retire. But after the victory at Badr, the younger generation wanted action and managed to carry the day. Muhammad, who was not the supreme commander, had to bow to this disastrous decision. The main Jewish tribes refused to fight, and Ibn Ubay withdrew his men from the army. So, on the following morning, Muhammad faced the Quraysh outnumbered 3-1. As the two armies began their advance, Abu Sufyan's wife, Hind, marched behind the Meccans with the other women, singing war songs and beating their tambourines. The Muslims were routed almost immediately with a brilliant charge by the Meccan cavalry. Muhammad was knocked senseless, and word spread that he had been killed. He had only been stunned. But the Quraysh did not bother to check the rumour and failed to follow up their advantage. The Muslim survivors were thus able to retreat in fairly good order. 22 Meccans and 65 Muslims had been killed, including Muhammad's uncle Hamza, a renowned fighter. The Quraysh ran onto the battlefield and mutilated the corpses. One of them cut out Hamza's liver and carried the gruesome trophy to Hind, who ate a morsel of it to avenge her brother, who had died by Hamza's hand at Badr. She then cut off his nose, ears and genitals, urging the other women to follow her example. And to the disgust of some of their Bedouin allies, they left the field sporting grisly bracelets, pendants and collars. Before his army moved off, Abu Sufyan heard the disappointing news that Muhammad had not, after all, been among the casualties. "Next year at Badr," he cried as a parting challenge. "Yes," one of the Muslims shouted on Muhammad's behalf, "it is an appointment between us." The Muslim defeat could have been worse. Had the Quraysh followed up their charge, they could have destroyed the Muslim community. But the psychological impact of Uhud was catastrophic. When Muhammad returned home after the battles, sick and shaken, he heard loud lamentation outside the mosque. It was the wives of the helpers mourning their dead. The Muslims fiercely resented Ibn Ubay's refusal to fight. When he rose to speak in the mosque on the following Friday, one of the helpers grabbed him and told him to keep his mouth shut. He strode from the mosque in fury and refused to ask for Muhammad's forgiveness. Hitherto, the hypocrites, as the Quran calls Ibn Ubay's supporters, had been wavering, waiting to see how things would turn out. Now they became openly hostile. Muhammad's victory at Badr, they claimed, had been a flash in the pan. He had brought death and destruction to Medina. Each of the Muslim dead had left wives and daughters without protectors. After the defeat, a revelation came to Muhammad, giving Muslims permission to take 4 wives. Muslims must remember that God had created men and women from a single living entity, so that both sexes were equally precious in his sight. Hence, render unto the orphans their possessions, and do not substitute bad things of your own for the good things that belong to them, and do not consume their possessions together with your own. This, verily, is a great crime. And if you have reason to fear that you may not act equitably towards orphans, then marry from among other women such as are lawful to you, even 2 or 3 or 4. But if you have reason to fear that you might not be able to treat them with equal fairness, then only 1, or from among those whom you rightfully possess. This will make it more likely that you will not deviate from the right course. The institution of polygamy has been much criticised as the source of considerable suffering for Muslim women. But at the time of this revelation, it constituted a social advance. In the pre-Islamic period, both men and women were allowed several spouses. After marriage, a woman remained at the home of her family and was visited by all her husbands. It was, in effect, a form of licensed prostitution. Paternity was therefore uncertain, so children were usually identified as the descendants of their mothers. Men did not need to provide for their wives and took no responsibility for their offspring. But Arabia was in transition. The new spirit of individualism in the peninsula meant that men were becoming more interested in their own children and were more assertive about personal property and wanted their sons to inherit their wealth. The Quran encouraged this trend toward a more patriarchal society. Muhammad endorsed it by taking his wives into his own household and providing for them, and the verses instituting polygamy take it for granted that Muslim men will do the same. But the Quran was also aware of a social problem that this new revelation sought to redress. In the pre-Islamic period, a woman could not own property. Any wealth that came her way belonged to her family and was administered by her male relatives. But in Mecca, where individualism was more pronounced than elsewhere in Arabia, some of the more aristocratic women had been able to inherit and administer their own fortunes. Khadija was a case in point. But this was still rare in Mecca and almost unheard of in Medina. Most men found the idea that women could inherit and manage their property quite ludicrous. Women had no individual rights. How could they? Apart from a few notable exceptions, they did nothing to contribute to the economy. And because they took no part in the ghazu, they brought no wealth to the community. Traditionally, women were considered part of a man's estate. After his death, his wives and daughters passed to his male heirs, who often kept them unmarried and impoverished in order to control their inheritance. The Quranic institution of polygamy was a piece of social legislation. It was designed not to gratify the male sexual appetite, but to correct the injustices done to widows, orphans, and other female dependents who were especially vulnerable. All too often, unscrupulous people seized everything and left the weaker members of the family with nothing. They were often sexually abused by their male guardians or converted into a financial asset by being sold into slavery. Ibn Ubay, for example, forced his women slaves into prostitution and pocketed the proceeds. The Quran bluntly refutes this behaviour and takes it for granted that a woman has an inalienable right to her inheritance. Polygamy was designed to ensure that unprotected women would be decently married and to abolish the old, loose, irresponsible liaisons. Men could have only four wives and must treat them equitably. It was an unjustifiably wicked act to devour their property. The Quran was attempting to give women a legal status that most Western women would not enjoy until the 19th century. The emancipation of women was a project dear to the Prophet's heart, but it was resolutely opposed by many of the men in the Ummah, including some of his closest companions. In a society of scarcity, it took courage and compassion to take financial responsibility for four women and their children. Muslims must have confidence that God would provide. Marry the spouseless among you, and your slaves and handmaidens that are righteous. If they are poor, God will enrich them of his bounty. God is all-embracing, all-knowing. After Uhud, he took another wife, providing a home for Zainab bint Khuzaimah, a widow whose husband had died at Badr. She was also the daughter of the Bedouin chief of the tribe of Amir, and so the match forged a new political alliance. An apartment was built for her beside the mosque, and she joined the other wives, her sisters as they called each other, Sauda, Aisha and Hafsa, there. The Prophet did not regard his women as chattel. They were his companions, just like the men. He usually took one of his wives along on a military campaign and disappointed his commanders by spending the whole of every evening in their tent instead of bonding with his men. In the camp, the women did not remain meekly secluded, but walked around freely, taking an interest in everything that was going on. This type of freedom had been common for elite women in pre-Islamic Arabia, but it infuriated Umar.
"Your boldness borders on insolence," he yelled when he came one day upon Aisha strolling along the front lines. "What if disaster overtakes us? What if there is a defeat and people are taken captive?" Muhammad's domestic arrangements gave his wives a new access to politics, and they seemed quite at home in this sphere. It would not be long before other women began to feel similarly empowered, and his enemies would use this women's movement to discredit the Prophet. Muhammad had to recover the prestige he had lost at Uhud. He could not risk another open confrontation with the Quraysh, but nor could he afford to show his weakness. Two incidents in the summer of 625 showed how vulnerable he was. Two of the Bedouin tribes of Najd, a region to the west of Medina, had asked for instruction in Islam, so Muhammad sent six of his ablest men. During their journey, they were attacked by one of the chiefs of Qudaid, the city of the goddess Manat, whose cult had been condemned by the Quran. Three of the Muslims were killed, the others taken prisoner. One was stoned to death when he tried to escape, and the other two were sold as slaves in Mecca and afterwards taken outside the sanctuary and crucified.
This ends Disc 4.